Just unpack what is unique about MoEngage, what is the product advantage today, why are you able to get customers to say it just works?
MoEngage.
Great partner in terms of building out our customer engagement.
MoEngage for us has been a lot more than just platform.
Your first tryst with this problem statement, what exactly was that eureka moment that inspired you to say, I'm actually going to ditch what I'm building at Delight Circle and I'm going to actually completely pivot into a very, very different idea to solve a problem I've personally faced?
Thankfully or not thankfully, Delight Circle was not going anywhere.
MoEngage today touches 2 billion consumers on their mobile, on their email, on different sort of communication channels, whether it's text, web push, email push. There's very few companies in the world that can say 1 in 3 people in the world's population actually interacts with MoEngage in some form. What was the initial product insight? When customers say MoEngage is the best product out there,
so Indian companies needed much more full stack solutions. Just not only marketing capabilities, but also analytics capabilities. Once we raised our $25 million round in 2020, that's when we kind of like started seriously investing in the US. We put together like 5 to 10 member team across sales, marketing.
What's next for MoEngage?
I think.
Welcome to a very exciting episode of Zero to Infinity. We have two very special guests today. This is a company that both personally and as a firm, we've been privileged to be early partners with. Having seen their journey from zero to infinity and beyond, hopefully, it's been a fantastic partnership. And I'm really excited to welcome Ravi and Nara from MoEngage. We've spoken about a lot of SaaS companies, what it takes to build global software businesses from India. And a lot of companies like Freshworks and BrowserStack and so many other companies have kind of put India on the global SaaS map. One company that isn't spoken about as frequently is MoEngage, which is always very surprising to those of us who have been close to your journey, that the MoEngage story is not better known than what it is today, especially as it relates to all the success that you'll have seen. So I'm hoping that with this episode, more people actually know about MoEngage, more people actually know about all the hard work and all the effort that has gone in by both of you and the entire extended team into building MoEngage into what it is today. So firstly, welcome Ravi, Nara. Great to have you on the podcast.
Yep. Thank you, Tarun. Thank you, PD.
Yeah. So we're going to actually dive into a few topics. I'm going to actually first start by congratulating both of you. I know we're recording this early sort of October, but by the time this gets published, you guys would have announced your most recent financing round, which is going to be at least 100 million, probably closer to a couple of 100 million. So congratulations. We'll talk more about the fundraise and what it means. But let me rewind the clock a little bit. I first met you guys, I think this was 2017, if I remember correctly. Maybe it was mid or late of 17. I know we invested in sometime in 2018. I remember when I met you guys and we had the distinction of actually having seen your seed and series A round, and I don't think we partnered that at that stage, but we made up for that mistake and led your series B round. So I'm going to actually rewind back to the time that we first met you. MoEngage was a $2-3 million annualized revenue kind of business at that stage. I think you all had clients in India and maybe a handful of clients outside India and Southeast Asia and maybe a couple of clients outside in the US and Europe. But the seeds of what y'all were trying to build were already visible, right? Had fairly large, what we call digitally native businesses like, Taxi for Sure and Snapdeal and Book My Show in India. You had some of what you all call the digital migrators like the Domino's and some of the larger companies, Airtel, in fact, at that stage, also in India. But then you also had the Deutsche Telekom in Europe. And then you had, I think, if I remember, Ally Bank in the US at that stage, or maybe it came, McAfee was there at that stage, yep. Right? So just rewind the clock a little bit and tell me when you started, both of you all started MoEngage, what was the vision? And for those of our people in our audience who actually don't know what MoEngage does, just start by dumbing it down because not too many people understand what MoEngage does. Mm-hmm. Explain what MoEngage is and just rewind back to what was the vision at that stage.
So MoEngage today is a customer engagement platform for consumer brands and one of the largest platforms in our category. So we primarily help consumer brands to keep it simple, like better engage and retain their customers, and help them increase their customer lifetime value and conversions and revenue, right? The way we do that is that we help these brands like really understand their customers better by leveraging all the data, by leveraging all the behavioral data, and basically leverage all of this, and then we provide a platform for their marketing and product teams to create all these campaigns and workflows and automations in the platform, and also leverage all the AI capabilities in Moengage, where we automatically kind of understand which customer should be communicated with which communication or which offer, which incentive or which information, and also at the right time at the right channel, right? So that's the broader problem that we are trying to solve. And today we work with over 1350 consumer brands. 1350 plus consumer brands globally with a global footprint, and we can talk about more of that, and with an employee base of 800 employees today. So that's what we are. Obviously, when we started, I mean you don't think that far, and I can talk about more in terms of like what was the initial thought process. And
so let me dumb it down again, just so that, you know, people who are listening actually understand Moengage. I think Moengage today touches 2 billion consumers on their mobile, on their, you know, email, on, you know, different sort of communication channels, whether it's text, web push, email push. There's very few companies in the world that can say 1 in 3 people in the world's population actually interacts with Moengage in some form. They probably don't know it, but there are very few companies from India that has reached that scale. The best way I describe Moengage to people who aren't as close to what the company does is, you know, open your mobile phone and there will be some app which is basically communicating you through mobile push, the notifications you get on your mobile phone, the web push, email, text messages, you know, different channels. And the underlying infrastructure that is powering that intelligence and the delivery of that notification is basically what Moengage is built.
Yes, yes. There's a lot that goes into before a message is delivered to someone.
And so I actually want to unpack that, and I know we'll come to that. But let me rewind it a little bit, and I'm going to pull in TD because he's had the benefit of actually both building while he was part of Freshworks and investing now in SaaS and, you know, enterprise software businesses as part of Z47. So I want to pull him in. But before that, I want to actually ask you, Ravi, you were running a startup before, and, you know, in VC, this folklore always is that, you know, what's the core unique insight and what's the unfair advantage? And, you know, you want to back somebody who has personally faced a problem, and you're a textbook example of that. Yep. So you were building, if I remember correctly, Delight Circle with Yashwant, who's your co-founder. He's not on the podcast today, but, you know, I know you will represent him as well. Tell me about your first tryst with this problem statement. And what exactly was that eureka moment that inspired you to say, I'm actually going to ditch what I'm building at Delight Circle and I'm going to actually completely pivot into a very, very different idea to solve a problem I've personally faced?
Yeah, I think so Delight Circle, when we were building, it was actually, or when we had the mobile app, the good part was that it was one of the first few mobile businesses back then.
Right? What was Delight Circle?
It was basically a consumer app which helped people discover offers and coupons from local stores and retailers. This was like 2011, 2012, like even before like Flipkart or like Zomato or had mobile applications, right? So much early on, so that, which also meant that we experienced problems as a mobile company ourselves much earlier than many other mobile companies back then, right? So we figured out how to acquire customers. I mean, there's ways to acquire customers. I mean that also is not easy, but we figured. But then what we realized is that, like, we also acquired customers at like good cost, like investing in Facebook ads and so on. But they realized that there's a lot of customers who actually kind of churn and uninstall within just like few weeks or a month. And then we were figuring out what are the drivers? How do we kind of engage the customers during those initial onboarding phase, or how do we drive people who are installing to activate customers and drive repeats and so on, right? So it's a problem that we experienced ourselves, like you mentioned, and we looked out for solutions. There were none. Most of the solutions were either analytics platforms, which were telling us what's going wrong, which we were able to understand. But and then there are all these marketing automation platforms which are out there, but they were more solving for email-centric and web-centric businesses.
There's nothing which is mobile-first.
Which is not mobile-first. Thankfully or not thankfully, Delight Circle was not going anywhere. so it kind of like, it's not like, okay, we kind of like, hey, we it was, we did not have a choice. And we basically said that, okay, it's anyways not going well. And this is an insight that we had. And we said, we already spent 3 years into building, doing startups. We probably have like max 1 year before our parents will like they will lose out on us, right? So I think then we said, okay, let's because it's an insight that we identified, let's try something completely different. Then we start speaking to some mobile companies. I think I remember the first 5-10 conversations were like Book My Show was one of them, like some of the taxi companies were there, and so on. Like,
so your pitch to them was very clear. You are acquiring customers. I'm going to help you figure out a way, yes, to activate and retain those customers. Was exactly that the one-line pitch?
Exactly. I think the timing was so good. I mean, because everyone was moving from like 2011 to 14, everyone
web,
was
web to mobile,
focused,
yeah,
on,
especially in India. I remember Flipkart had gone to this whole mobile-only strategy.
This was so, like Flipkart went all in like maybe a couple of years later, yeah, right? But everyone kind of like built mobile apps. Now they start driving customer base. Then they realize this big problem. And then so everyone and I spoke with, like, the pain was very acute, very clear. And then basically, like, then we took a lean approach in terms of like, okay, we built a small prototype, nothing works behind the scenes, showed the product, showed like the prototype, gave a pricing to it. We did not ask for feedback. I think because we had very less time as individuals that, okay, we can't keep, like, we have to kind of either kind of like go back to like to finding a job or basically kind of keep doing. So we had very low time, less time. So which made us, kept us a lot more honest to ourselves, and so we didn't have to go and ask for feedback. And the best part is we didn't have a network. So we basically none of the initial companies that were showing, talking to us came out of the like the friends
Founders
and
network.
Family or network, right? So the and there was very clear interest to kind of use a product. So that's where one fine day, like Taxi for Sure basically said, okay, we want to use our product from next week, and we are okay with the pricing. So then we started building fast.
Yeah.
So yeah, it went very quickly from there.
And as it turned out, I think if I remember correctly, a lot of SaaS companies initially sell, the first million ARR comes by selling to network, friends, family, and get, yes, feedback, and which is fine. You know, people will do, yeah, whatever it takes to get that initial revenue and that initial validation. I think in your case, it actually was the reverse that played out, which is,
yes,
a lot of your customers like the product enough to say that I want to become an investor in your company.
Yes.
And I think Rohit and Kunal from Snapdeal are both, yes, customers first and then became, yes, investors in the company. And also Raghu from Taxi for Sure.
Yeah. As Ravi mentioned, Taxi for Sure was one of our early customers. Raghu liked it so much that he wanted to be invested.
And you all didn't know them before this in any fashion.
No.
So it all just customers who said, I love what you're building and I want to invest.
In fact, our first engine check was in Series A. We did
Series A. Before that.
So Raghu and Rohit and Kunal, as you mentioned, from Snapdeal, and even Anand, who was a CPO back in
Snapdeal,
in Airtel, and Snapdeal also continued to believe in the product and invest in Series A. So we didn't have any angel check series until Series A, which is very different to most of the
most companies.
Series,
yeah.
So, yeah.
Actually, again, comparing my journeys were very different. So there's always this question of when you're starting out, do I start with India or do I go to the US? So how did you think about it back in the day? And if you reflect on it today, if a young founder is asking you for advice, what would your advice to them be?
So we actually wanted to do the US.
Yeah.
So we got into an accelerator called Alchemist.
Yes.
In 2014.
Yeah, I remember speaking to them, yeah.
And they actually are primarily a B2B SaaS accelerator.
Okay.
And then, so I think we got into the accelerator. Like I was spending time in the US. Yashwant kind of like spent some time and then came back to India. But interestingly, what happened is that when we started doing pitches to Indian companies, Indian mobile app companies, and so we were like there's a lot of interest from Indian companies. So we went on kind of, okay, we found this, like, whenever we spoke to any other mobile app company in India, we were able to kind of, and they were able to kind of, they wanted to use the product, they wanted to pay for it. And the access was a bit more easier. Mm. And so initially I was selling for the first 18 months, I was 12 to 18 months, I was selling more into, actually I was being in the US, selling into India, signing these customers. Snapdeal became a customer even before, they actually went live even before I met them actually. Mm. Multiple such companies like Ghana and so on, I did not even meet them. So it's like,
oh, I remember Ghana used to be a big customer at that time also.
Yeah, and most of those 10 customers actually, like, other than a couple, actually I did not even meet them. Mm. So I think the product market fit was very
so
good.
Market India actually pulled you while you were still in the US trying to sell to US customers.
So curious, at that time, what were you hearing in the US? Like, what was feedback or?
So the timing in the US was also good at the time. I think it's just that like that lack of access was basically one big challenge for me at the time. I traveled to the US, kind of trying to figure out some connections and introductions. So basically, think we were also learning SaaS during this period.
As an ecosystem as a whole. So,
and as an individual, we were learning sales, how to sell, how to pitch, because we didn't do any a SaaS company or even worked in a SaaS company, right? So that actually, all of that was kind of there. So that baggage was there. And by the time we really, in Series A, when we raised capital, 4 or 5 million, we could have, then that's when we started putting few people on the ground in the US. I think in 2015-16, then the market in the US started becoming a bit more crowded in the mobile engagement space. Mm. Some of our key competitors raised quite a bit of capital. Then, which basically meant that you needed a lot more capital to kind of really make a big dent. Mm. Just few millions of dollars were not enough, right? And these were those days where SaaS was not an interesting thing for VCs, right? So it was actually challenging. So that kind of led us to hey, we were seeing traction in India, let's own India market. I mean, that's what we were kind of doing it. Yeah.
Obviously, North America is giving most of the growth today. So we'll come back to that journey. But second part of the question, if you were to advise a young founder today, right, starting out India versus US, what would your advice be?
Firstly, it obviously depends on the category. That is one thing that people ignore. But definitely, I would suggest going to the US market. And if your category kind of supports US market, has that open space or white space for your category, I think you should definitely kind of go and crack the US market. It's the largest software spend category. And once you crack the US, the opportunity to kind of scale up is much more linear in nature. So definitely, I think it just then comes down to the circumstances of people and the new deals. And there could be some cases where you're figuring out the product. See, I think the challenge that really happens in the beginning is that you're figuring out the product also, right? You're not sure. So in some cases where, hey, they have access to Indian companies, then they kind of try to validate whether the product is of value. That's still okay, I guess. But try to kind of go quickly to the US market if there is white space in your category. Or opportunity in your category. Yeah.
So one thing that a lot of people, by the way, I do want to make this point, as a VC, we obviously invest in lots of companies across sectors. And there are very few companies that consistently meet or beat plan. We've been fortunate to have a few of those in our portfolio. I think one example that we've spoken about was Five Star, which was a offline sort of lending, business. Did extremely well for us. There's a couple of others, but then MoEngage is also one of those. And I think save and except maybe the quarter or two during the first COVID year, where there was lots of companies asking for, some sort of a discount or some sort of this thing. I think.
Yep.
We've been associated now 8 years with MoEngage. I don't remember a single quarter or year where you guys have actually missed plan. And I think that's the hallmark of any good company, which is, you say X and you deliver X or a little bit more than X. And so, firstly, I think it's less spoken about, but I do want to commend you because there's not, you will be shocked how many companies actually do this. A lot of people will guide to a very aggressive plan and then fall significantly short. A lot of companies will give a more realistic plan and also still fall short. There are a few companies that, say I will do X and then, figure out a way to actually achieve that. So congratulations. I think you've done really well on that front. But I also feel you all have done, what a lot of people would just say, this is the boring stuff of company building. And you all have just done that extremely well. What do I mean by boring stuff? You've basically built a product that works. And every time I, people ask me, hey, what's unique about Moengage? They're operating in such a crowded category. It's a red ocean. There's like hundreds of, you know, MarTech players. They're doing X, but these three other competitors also do it. So what's really special about Moengage? What's the differentiation? And, you know, I struggle to ever give an answer. And you guys, I actually want you guys to give the answer because clearly you'll do a better job than I did. But I reached a point where I used to just say, you know what, I can only tell you what the customers tell me when I speak to them, which is it just works, right? And people used to say that about Apple and a lot of other products, which is, you know, it just works. And that's really what a customer cares about. So you'll have done some of that just stuff repeatedly and taken the long route, taken the hard route, taken the less immediate, you know, short-term gratification route. You'll have actually delayed that and you'll have gone after the difficult customer segment. You've gone after large enterprise customers. You've not fallen to the temptation of getting that, you know, young Series A funded startup, which may or may not be around 2 years from now, and gotten that as a customer to show your ARR. You've always taken your time and gone after the, you know, like I said, the boring, tough aspects of company building well. So we'll come to the GTM aspect. I actually wanted to dive into the product aspect, right? What was the initial product insight? I know when we evaluated our investment in Moengage, higher deliverability was one clear advantage. And higher deliverability of notifications means higher engagement. Higher engagement means, you know, higher retention, higher revenue. So there's a very clear ROI impact. Every marketer understands that. But is it just that? When customers say Moengage is the best product out there, and today it's not just against your domestic competitors, it's even versus some of the very large listed global sort of companies which are 5x or 10x your size.
Yep.
You guys are routinely churning out and sort of replacing them at very large enterprise, you know, businesses. So Ravi and Nara, both of you all, I would love to hear you from a tech and product and engineering perspective and you from a sales and, you know, biz dev perspective. Just unpack what is unique about Moengage. What is the product advantage today? Why are you able to get customers to say it just works?
Obviously, like if you look at the current state of Moengage, I mean, it went through a lot of continuous innovation and iteration, right? And I think firstly, it just comes down to like your having a very customer first philosophy. Everything else like is part of like which drives that. So basically having a very good customer first philosophy of understanding both the needs and challenges or the goals of our customers closely, and not just at a high level, but more at a low level. And just not just building for the need, but also building for where we want them to kind of take them to, right? Like in the first couple of years, we focused on building the best-in-class customer engagement platform for mobile apps. So companies with mobile apps primarily, and we were only focusing on the mobile apps. And first 2-3 years, and the good part is, I mean, even that part has become a core even after 11 years, right? Like being the best-in-class customer engagement platform if you're a mobile app company. Then it comes down, then in that case, what does that mean, right? It could be like, okay, helping them better understand customer insights at a granular level, which with all of our analytics capabilities.
Like, give me an example when you say better segment their user base and better activate and better retain. Give me one or two use cases.
So mobile app companies want to understand whether it is in terms of which customers to engage, right? I mean, and which customers to kind of, to which they need to kind of set up automations in terms of communications and so on, right? And there are different ways to segment customers. There are ways to kind of do rule-based segmentation, which is like, okay, I want to target customers who have an LTV of XYZ and haven't made a purchase in the last, let's say, 2 months, for example, right? So we first saw that, hey, can we help mobile app companies ingest huge amounts of data without any limits? And then can segment at the most granular level at hundreds of millions of customers, right? And we evolved our technology stack over the years, the segmentation technology stack, and we have a very good decoupled compute and storage architecture. When compared to our competition, for example, like Braze, where they actually kind of limit the amount of data on which the customers can segment on, right? So this is like a bit more fundamental part, right? Now then, how can we provide more intelligent ways to segment customers? It could be like predictive behaviors. People who have a propensity to do a purchase in the next, whatever, 1 month, or people who have a propensity to churn in the next 1 month, or people who have affinity towards a given category as an e-commerce company, right? Now we are taking to the even more next level, like how can we do automated decisioning? In the sense that, hey, instead of you kind of like While we have a lot of predictive capabilities, instead what we are saying is, okay, give us all your value propositions, like which you want to communicate. Let's say you want to drive repeat purchase from your existing customers. Now give all the different value propositions that you want to communicate. We will match automatically that which customer should receive what value proposition.
Mm.
So for example, if it is Instamart, like Swiggy Instamart, now there's a lot of people who purchase regularly, but there's a lot of people who are dormant, right? Now for them, there could be different value propositions that I want to communicate. It could be an offer, it could be a given category, or it could be anything else, right? Now instead of people having to do manually do all of these like matching and creating segments, you just leave it to us. We will do the automated matching and decisioning. And then we'll also kind of send it on the right day of the week and right time of the day and all of that. So which is more autonomous in nature, right? But all of these are evolutions that you come by, like listening and being closer to your customers and having that really, I would say, strong principle that you want to have a very complete product and solve for the real needs overall as a company, right? You don't want to be like people sometimes, what they also do is they go with like the shiny things, right?
Mm.
I just want to kind of build something that looks nice on a demo for sales, or just I want to show something on the slide. I mean, today with AI, that's what's happening. There's a lot of demo wear and slide wear.
Yeah.
I think keeping that focus that, okay, I want to deliver real results.
Value.
Now with all our AI capabilities, we show that, okay, what is the incrementality that you are able to derive as a marketing person or as a brand, you're able to show that clear result. So when your goal is that, okay, you want to really deliver value, then you kind of operate differently.
Yeah.
And even in terms of how we are designed as a org structure also, I think we have teams, smaller teams, while there's always new products that we build, the core parts of the product we continuously innovate and change on an ongoing basis. So for example, that's where the reach challenge came into picture, where we have seen that with some of these new devices coming into picture, reach was becoming a challenge. So we innovated on that part. So it's a continuous innovation taking a very customer first approach and having a very good feedback loop with customers and even prospects.
Yeah. Nara, I know you speak to a lot of investors, and I think one thing I should call out about your relationship, I've actually found that very, very unique about the two of you. In a lot of startups, we see that, you know, the founder wants to kind of control the entire fundraise, wants to be the person who's in front of every investor, doesn't want anyone else in the team to know what's happening. And I think Ravi is the 180 degree of that, and Ravi is very happy just building the product and letting you do the rest of it, right?
Yes.
And in fact, I think for the longest time, I think investors don't even meet Ravi until the deal is already sealed by you. So I think you will go down as one of the guys who just runs a very tight process of fundraising and closes the round faster than any other company that I know.
And a good combination of business plus finance.
Right? Exactly, right? So and so I actually wanted to get your view. So I actually love the partnership you guys have. And like I said, it's very unique. I want to ask you, when you speak to investors, you must be getting this question all the time. What is unique? How are you guys differentiating? Why is MoEngage special? What's your answer? Like, how do you explain this?
No, I think Ravi had put it in a broader product fashion, but I'll try to summarize, right? I think in the product side, it's not that one thing would stay forever. As I rightly mentioned, when you had invested, it was higher deliverability, which obviously means higher reachability,
yes,
higher retention, higher revenue for the brand. But over a period of time, today we are talking more about, you know, how can I match audiences without having to depend on the marketer's intelligence.
Mm-hmm.
When I say match audience, like, you know, can I automatically predict who are the users who are likely to buy a specific product in a category, for example, right? So let's say I want to segment users who want to buy, who have a potential to buy, you know, laptops in the next 1 week, 2 days,
yeah,
1 week, 2 weeks, and so on. And so it's very important to be able to innovate, keeping customer first focus on the product side, which I think Ravi has rightly put. And today it's all about how do I make customers and marketers' life easier when it comes to figuring out the right campaigns that they should run to drive more revenue. On the business side, I think we have a very unique story. I honestly believe knowing SaaS companies, seeing SaaS companies in the last 10, 11 years across different parts of the globe, we have a very unique story that can be sold and also be believe long-term sustainability, where obviously today you see us as a multi-segment and very horizontal in nature, but it took time to build and get here, right? I think today we are one of those very few SaaS companies at around 100 million scale, which has shown or built foundations across four different geographies, which doesn't have any similarity.
Yeah, it's very atypical. Most, and by the way, it's also, which is why you should not listen to VCs too much when building businesses. I think most people will tell you, pick a geography, pick a customer segment and go deep in that. And I think you all did that, by the way. I think you all have just sequenced it out really well. But today, and I didn't want to say it, but you guys are at 100 million sort of ARR, growing very fast, profitable or very soon to be profitable by the end of this calendar year. Been super capital efficient and you'll have done this in multiple geographies. So we will unpack that and I'll actually let Pranay also maybe talk about the different GTM sort of aspects of y'all getting there. But just conclude what you were saying on the product side and then we'll jump to that.
Yeah, no, I think on the product side, I think we believe, you know, we have shown a lot of money to our customers. And I think a lot of late stage investors speak to hundreds of customers. It's not one or two customers, unfortunately.
I've read some of those notes, yeah.
So they spend billions of dollars in doing diligence. It is not that they had investing only a couple of million dollars, right? So they speak to hundreds of customers. So at the end of the day, whatever you are building in the product has to translate in customers' love, which is what is clearly seen by investors today who do diligence across multiple consultancy firms, which obviously makes my life easier.
Yeah, so the customer conversations are what really kind of give the comfort to the incoming investors, right?
So maybe talking a little more about the go-to-market, you figured out the product works in India, you figured out these early anchor customers who have now become investors. Where did you go from there? Because I think at time of entry, we saw a lot of not just digital natives, but also traditional enterprise logos. So did that happen? Was there a conscious plan? So let's talk about India growth first and then we'll go.
And also how much of your GTM and product extended from India when you went to Southeast Asia, then you all did Middle East and Europe. Now US is the fastest growing market. And just to, again, for sort of the viewers, you're at about sort of 100 million plus ARR, you're 25 to 30% US today.
30%.
And that's your fastest growing geography. You're more than doubling year on year over there. Yeah. India and Southeast Asia combined would be about 45-50%.
Together.
Together would be about half the business today. And that's also growing very rapidly. And then rest of the world, which is Europe and Middle East. Is the rest, right? So there are very few companies that can actually boast of so many different engines of growth, right? And I know it's easy from a distance to say, are you just doing too many things and are you all spread too thin? But how much of what you all did on the product in India was, you know, extended into the, you know, Southeast Asia and then US? How different was the GTM? Like, was this all just, you know, rinse and repeat, or was it like there was a lot of, you know, tweaking to be done in each geography, both on product and go to market?
I think obviously digital natives are early adopters for any SaaS product, right? All of us know that they're the ones who can buy at a faster velocity. So while obviously Ravi mentioned at the beginning of the podcast where we had Snap deals and, you know, some of the early customers which are digital natives you can think of, but we also had at a very early stage Airtel as a customer, right? Like back in 2015, we signed up Airtel, which I don't think any of those companies in software could have tried to even pitch to Airtel, right?
Yeah.
Maybe we are one of the first customers who would have sold to.
How did that happen?
I can anecdote some of the conversations from our conversations where you'll be surprised where, you know, the supply chain guy comes and says, why do I need to pay for email? I send an email every day to my colleagues. And, you know, I don't care for it, right? Like, so we have seen televisions where, you know, where people does not even understand why they have to buy software. But no, I think it obviously, maybe Ravi can touch upon the initial conversation on the product side, but on the Airtel, it's obviously, it's a long sale that happened and it took us. They started using the product, but it took us good probably 1 year to sign the contract.
To sign the contract.
So it was not easy pace with it. So, but having said that, we have seen that there's a clear validation from the customers who are enterprise, right? So which is typically not the case at the early stage of
SaaS companies,
right? And obviously, Airtel, I don't think was a conscious choice to go after Airtel, but it just happened naturally because they had introduced a product called Wink, which is Wink Music and Wink Movies. But over a period of time, obviously, they expanded to the entire Airtel ecosystem and we saw a clear need on the enterprise side as well, right? And back in those days, I think we didn't have anyone in the banks as a customer, or we didn't have anyone in the traditional enterprise as a customer.
Today, was ICICI Bank a customer at that time? No, it became later.
Indus,
LIC obviously was a big account that cracked earlier this year.
Last couple of quarters, right? Yeah.
So some of these, so that's the other thing, and maybe you can touch upon that. I know what the other question I used to always feel from, you know, anyone who was looking to invest was, how large is the TAM? Kitna hi bada TAM hai? How can you build a large company on sending, you know, this with this kind of customer engagement platform? And I think that question went away post-COVID because every company in the world became a digital company.
Right. Yep.
A bank has a mobile app, a retailer has a mobile app, a media company has a mobile app. Website. Everybody has a mobile app, right?
Any digital touchpoint.
And any digital touchpoint. Touch
which became a norm after COVID, right? And I think it obviously evolved, right? Like earlier when we had customers in e-commerce in India, people thought e-commerce in India is a term. And when we expanded into, let's say, media and
BFSI,
now, the time is infinite. Right? Every consumer company across globe can be a customer of Moengage. And today, the TAM, thankfully, question doesn't
come.
I think India, for us, we wanted to be a clear category leader. So which meant that like we want to go after like across all the categories of consumer B2C, right? I think that's so which meant that, I mean, obviously we had to crack the banks and all insurance and all sorts of traditional enterprise segments. I think the key transformation, I would say, like the change that we made in 2020, like the org structure design change that we made once we became serious about multiple markets, we changed the org structure to a more regional plus functional org structure. And we gave a clear goal to the India region team that, hey, we want to be the category leader, which meant that one, we identified all these traditional enterprise segments that we need to win. We also realized that in the first couple of years, it took a lot of time. Like especially kind of selling to banks, it takes pretty long time to kind of close. Basically we said, okay, but we learned a lot of it in terms of like what does it take to kind of crack a bank, not just like a point solution, but crack as a much more unified full stack solution, right? It's easy to kind of like maybe get in like a point solution, but we also wanted to kind of get in as a full stack solution. So I think, then which also meant that based on the learnings and feedback, then we basically kind of built some of the things in the product. For example, in case of traditional banks or traditional enterprises, there are things around data management, how to ingest data differently and all of that. So we built all of those capabilities, right? And in some cases we did land and expand, like, okay, land as a mobile solution, but then expand as a full stack solution, all of that. But the idea, I think, in India is like we wanted to become like the category leader across every vertical or every industry. Like the way we tracked like last two, three years is that, okay, traditional enterprise, one way I tell our team is that, okay, let's take all the public companies, then let's get all of the, we need to kind of track our coverage with regards to how many public companies of India are working with us. Right, which will be all your retailers, banks, insurance, and all of that, and even like CPG brands and so on. So I think the names that we work with today, I think you'll be very surprised that we are working with those.
We'll
brands.
Actually put like, that up, and I know that you'll have this beautiful slide with all the marquee customers across different segments. So we'll put
that. And also like in India, like we work with like even jewelry brands and so on, right? So yeah, I think the main thing on India from the product standpoint, like few things that we did is. So Indian companies needed much more full stack solutions, just not only marketing capabilities, but also analytics capabilities. And even from the marketing standpoint, not because there was no like in the US, some of the enterprises were working with some of the email solutions like Salesforce Marketing Cloud and Oracle Marketing Cloud and so on. So in India, we ended up having to become the CRM system of record, which is a great opportunity for us. So we built, like we covered all the touch points and channels for a given consumer brand, both in terms of data collection as well as channels of engagement. Then the analytics became, we wanted to kind of build the whole analytics product, which enables both marketing and product teams to better understand behavior and all of that. So we built that as well. Then we added obviously a lot of AI capabilities and so on. The reach part, I mean, like in India, like one of the things were in terms of the channels like push notifications is like there's a lot of Chinese device manufacturers where the deliverability was challenging. So we solved for that problem as well. So yeah, I think we became much more full stack solution. I think that really is a transformation that we had to do. And now in the last 2 years, like we became like what we call it as customer data and engagement platform. Because there's a lot of these traditional enterprise brands first need to get the data right. They need to kind of bring data together beyond the activation part. So we focus a lot more on the data side of it in the last couple of years.
I think in summary, I think Indian customers definitely helped us to create breadth and depth of the platform, right? Like it is very important to have a full stack when you go abroad or when you compete with companies which are public, the large scale. This whole value prop of Salesforce, Adobe is like, I'm the full stack, you can buy any kind of product from me, you don't have to worry about anyone else, right? So I think having a breadth and depth, Indian customers really make you to go on depth of the platform as well. And also given that there is no history of using Salesforce, Adobe, they wanted us to solve more use cases, which we kind of helped us increase the depth of the breadth of the platform.
And I think US is usually point solutions, India is more all-in-one, so it helps sort
which
of beef up.
And every category goes through that, right? I mean, there's like unification and and like more.
There's two ways to make money, bundle and unbundle.
So. So exactly.
So maybe switching to Tarun's question, right? Now Indian customers, especially the enterprises, have helped you beef up the product. Now you thought about going international, right? And curious and broad-based question, what does it take to get it right? Right? Because I think a lot of founders make mistakes. I think one of our investors back at Freshworks had told us that even if product is ready, if you've not solved for, you know, for brand, trust, pipeline, you go hire a lot of sales reps and suddenly you look at it and you're like, okay, I have like an unprofitable sales team in region burning like tens of millions.
Then you shut the market and come back.
And then you say the market is wrong and then you come back. Had to cut burn aggressively, right? So that journey can sometimes be lethal for a company, right? So you've done it right. You've kind of taken your time in some cases, but you've gotten it right in each of these geographies. So what does it take or what were some decisions?
So do you want to share more like what it takes for another founder? Because we obviously went through similar learnings and failures, right? So, I mean, first is obviously like if I'm answering more from the standpoint of like what a like a new SaaS founder should do once they kind of have some level of product market fit validation that, okay, the product is actually solving for the needs of the customer. I think first, obviously, like choosing the market to go after, which if assumingly it could be the US market. I think first, I mean, obviously kind of getting, I mean, the key outcome you want to solve for is getting some referenceable customers, right? Like whether it is 5 or 10, whatever the number is. I mean, you want to kind of first, like, don't look too far, like how do you kind of get to that referenceable number of customers as an outcome. But to get to that outcome, then you need to kind of like one, like have enough conversations to start with, right? And enough conversations with the with your ICP, whether it could be like a CIO within a, I mean, like whether it is IT or product or marketing within a brand. So try to kind of figure ways to kind of get to enough number of conversations, then which will help you identify, okay, which are sort of the companies where you have the most fitment, right? Let's say initially for us, like whether it is any market that we were, like we had like commerce companies with high focus on mobile apps were our target segment. So we just focused on that segment, right? So identifying that segment and then getting enough conversations is obviously the key part. I mean, obviously you leverage the network. The second is, I mean, we also have done in some cases when we are exploring new markets like Latin America and so on, like we even have leveraged like platforms like GLG and so on to kind of get to conversations, which might be more for insight generation, not necessarily for actual selling, but it can also help you into kind of like having that future for the conversations. What I've seen some other good founders have done is they also kind of been able to bring some of these IC personas in ICPs, like in like what you call it as an advisory board or sort of network.
Like a customer advisory board,
Like a CAB or something. And like even like a CMO advisory board in our case could be an example. And that could be a one way to kind of like also bring some thought leaders in your network. And then obviously, then you obviously need to obviously have a small mini team. We call it as like, okay, minimum team of like, whether it is, again, depends on the stage of the product, assuming they have raised capital. So they basically like a small sales and marketing and someone, obviously in this case, mostly the founder should be the leading the most of the go-to-market work.
So how much were you involved? Let's say, so India, you had reached market leadership position in the first 3 or 4 years after you, know, you all started. I remember then you all targeted Indonesia to be like, I think that was the next big one. If I remember correctly, you all were actually very early to the Indonesian market, almost built the market over there. I know you all were later to the US than you would have liked today with the benefit of hindsight, but now have caught up. How much was your involvement in that 0-1 at Indonesia, at sort of Middle East, now in the US?
Yeah, I mean, Southeast Asia, for example, I mean, I was involved in all the important conversations. Thankfully, we were able to kind of find someone like with a founder mindset whom we were able to send to Southeast Asia to kind of like to the key goal of, okay, get good, referenceable customers.
Who was the largest, like big logo you all got?
So we, in the first 10 customers, we had the largest e-commerce platform, Tokopedia.
Tokopedia.
Largest travel platform and so key names. We did not go after what is the easiest. While we got some mid-sized ones, but we focused on getting the largest, because once you get the larger ones,
it's easier to,
kind of like everyone else will follow. I mean, but again, Southeast Asia is like was a greenfield market, right? I mean, like, okay, we were almost like establishing the category of the customer engagement back then, right? And so, and in the US, when we started out 2021, when we kind of came into the US market in a more serious fashion, so you obviously as founder, you basically have to be very closely involved in all the sales conversations to get those first 10 good referenceable customers, right? So definitely very closely involved and still involved. Now the bar obviously of the involvement changes, like now you're obviously involved in maybe in like larger deals, like $500,000 plus conversations and so on, right? In the Western markets, for example.
So I know in India and Southeast Asia, I think the early GTM was digitally native. And then over time, you all also got into the more traditional sort of digital migrators, as you all call it. Has US been given, I guess, all the digitally native early customers were captured by some of your competitors? Has US largely been more traditional business?
Yeah, so when we, like I can share, like when we went to the US, how we kind of went, right? So, I mean, we obviously didn't have enough capital until 2020. So once we raised our $25 million round in 2020, that's when we kind of like started, I would say, seriously investing in the US. We put together like 5 to 10 member team across sales, marketing. One of our people who kind of led the expansion in Southeast Asia moved to the US. We moved that person to the US to kind of be very closely. I mean, basically you reduce the variables of failure, right? I mean, like, okay, you reduce the variables of, okay, of the people that you want to trust. Then obviously we kind of had a bit more capital where we kind of like, the good part is we were entering US like after 6 years of the company founding with a very strong product. Also, we did meaningful amount of marketing globally also in terms of content and so on. So we were not starting like we were getting some inbound leads already. It was not like from zero. We were getting inbound leads. One problem was that, okay, we were not able to convert them, which is basically because, like you said, like one of the points that comes up is that who do you work with in the US? Not just who do you work with in like big, but who do you work with in the US?
And sometimes in my vertical.
In my vertical is also another main thing that comes up, right? So we basically had to do a lot more than a usual sales rep of a competitor. That's the way I would put it, right? Which is basically like, okay, whether in our sales conversations, we need to understand the business much better, write our, I mean, a good number of those inbound leads are properly like evaluations, right? Mm. Like RFP evaluations and evaluations where you're kind of competing with other players. So we had to kind of solution our products better to the customer's needs. And obviously I was closely involved. That is where it basically helps that me be involved. And we've learned some things. I mean, like how do you kind of nurture execs during the sales process? One of the gaps that we identified was that, okay, if you don't nurture and engage execs during the sales process in a larger deals, there's very less, you don't have the right to win. So those are some learnings that we had. So we basically figured, okay, I think PD was mentioning that, okay, it's just not about having a great product. For them, the two main things that matter is, can they have trust in us as company? And then basically the de-risking part, like, we, from our side, we need to de-risk this decision, right? So which is where we spent time kind of like, okay, having those exact conversations and sharing our vision and roadmap and product roadmap and so on. And how we would work very closely with you. That's where, I mean, in the first 10 such really good deals, you just need to go all in. One needs to go all in and then just make those happen. And once you have those, then we figured ways to kind of amplify that that piece. Like, for example, we did like regional events, for example, where we brought our customers as well as prospects. So for example, in these sort of situations, like if our prospect meets some of our customers and hears from them directly, they obviously will get the trust, right? And then we did larger events like our customer engagement summit, growth summits and so on. So I think those are some ways kind of we amplified once we started getting some meaningful initial customers.
I think one feedback we used to get very often in the early customer base, like 5-10 customers, is that when you send out an RFP, a normal sales rep of a US large software company, they don't spend enough time understanding the customer's business and actually writing an RFP in a way that they feel that you understood your business really well, right?
Yeah.
So that's a big feedback, right? Our customers always felt after looking at the RFP that Moengage has understood my problems really well and actually has given a solution to my problem than explaining Moengage's product.
Which is amazing, actually.
Just speaking the customer language.
And it's funny, like, you know, all these things, like I said, I think one thing that I always, you know, even Moengage is like, you're just doing the stuff which is so obvious.
Yeah.
That you're just doing it consistently. And you're doing it over long periods of time. You've not done something which nobody else has ever spoken about, right? Or there's something really unique that nobody else knows. It's just all the stuff which is known and, you know, what it takes to build a great company, and you've just done it well.
Doing it consistent.
Yeah,
I think the harder part, I think most companies say is that they stop at some point.
Yeah.
Like, I think doing it consistently is what...
I think common sense and execution prevails.
So I remember when I joined the VC business, a very seasoned investor, I asked him, what does it take to build a great VC brand, a great VC firm? And he said, listen, you can do all the marketing, but a great VC brand is built one great investment at a time. That's it. There's no other way. And I think the same holds true for y'all, which is a great enterprise software business is built one good logo at a time.
And
there's no shortcut. There is really no other way to do it.
Correct.
Yes.
I want to ask you, you spoke about trust and credibility and, you know, all that. I remember even when I invested, this was 2018, you guys were already part of, I think, Gartner.
Correct.
I don't think Forrester was there at that time. I mean, you guys were on the Forrester Wave report, but shortly thereafter did that.
Yep.
And I was very surprised that for a business which was largely India and Southeast Asia centric, you guys had already invested the energy, the time, the effort, the resources to actually engage with analysts at Gartner and Forrester and made sure that you guys were starting to get mentioned in those reports many years before you all actually entered the US market. And today, as a result of that, like you said, you get a lot of inbound leads, RFPs, etc. And here I would like to bring in PD perspective, because he would have seen maybe a very different playbook that Freshworks used when you all kind of expanded to the US and into different categories. So is that like, was that all very well thought through? How did it happen? Like, is that something that was
maybe
a big
I can
driver
start
of and, your success in some of these markets?
Yeah, I'll start and let Ravi add. But see, I think, again, probably a question from common sense, right? Like, if I'm trying to expand to new geographies, the biggest question that I would ask myself is, why would customer speak to me?
Mm.
Right. So obviously, you know, all these things that we've built in the last 10, 11 years is today helping us get the leads organically. But I think an important question to ask yourself that, you know, if I'm entering into a new market, if I'm having to have, let's say, 15 conversations to be able to convert, let's say, one or two large referenceable logos, how can I make these 15 customer conversations happen? And unfortunately, as Ravi mentioned, we didn't have access to a lot of network in US back in those days. And we obviously also were figuring out what are the ways people look at when they look for solutions. And Gartner was something which came out really
right at the spot where, you know, large enterprise customers look at these reports when they are in the buying cycle, to be able to figure out and to be able to speak to multiple vendors in the space and multiple partners in the space. And I think happened very early for us, while we have not invested into US market until 2021, right? So, but we always had a couple of people in US to ensure.
Yeah, I think I'll add to that, right? Exactly. Basically, while we did not seriously invest into the US till 21, in 2016 is where we started putting few people in on the ground, and then two, and then maybe then expand to three and four people. I think one advice that came to me at that time, which I think like, which helped me, like, obviously, investors would tell you, okay, why do you want, like, okay, if it's not working, why do you want to kind of keep continuing to do, even on a smaller scale?
I may have asked you the same question.
So even on a smaller scale, right? I mean, we were investing like $500,000 to $1 million a year. But I think one advice that came well for me was like, okay, US is a market where you need to have patience. Might not be in the current AI part, but back then, I think, like, that's the advice that came to me, that, okay, just stay, don't leave. From a founder of a SaaS company who left, I don't want to name them, but so I kind of like, okay, let's stay on, let's keep put it, and that's where staying in the from the staying standpoint, Gartner is one such part. Like, we invested in analyst relations, and invested in content and some of the outreach and so on. Even though we didn't have enough capital to kind of really kind of do it at a much larger scale, but we were kind of there. But that gave us some good learnings in terms of like, okay, what does it take to kind of properly invest? So that could be one learning for some of the founders, that, hey, if like, don't go in the US market thinking that it will happen, something will happen in 12 months.
Yeah.
It takes time. And especially when you don't have that access in the network. So you'll have to kind of give it time. And some people have, and we have seen, like, whether it in our category or other categories, like, people go a bit more overboard.
Too aggressive, too early, and
put in billboards and so on. Then also, like, I mean, we have had Lean Plum, one example, like, they went all in. So even then also, then there is like, okay, if you don't have that, like, the whole proper muscle and the overall pipeline that's coming, and then the everything is kind of working properly, these things immediately when you put in and they don't yield results immediately, right? Then you're kind of, your metrics completely kind of go off board. So yeah, I think those are some of the learnings.
Like, sometimes capital cannot accelerate.
Yes.
PD, I want to bring you in. Tell me your perspective on this. You've seen this at Freshworks, and you've now obviously on the boards of multiple SaaS companies.
So I think obviously very different DNA, because that was SMB, online sales, very high.
But even Freshworks was obviously going mid-market and going up market in
so
the US.
Interestingly, the first time we hired sales reps on the ground was mid-2014. First time we doubled down on like enterprise reps was 2016. The first person we hired in the US was this guy, Alan, 2013, analyst relations.
Analyst relations, right?
So it came before because I think, see, for a lot of founders, like, trust, and you know, there is this brand trust recognition, then there is pipeline, then there is sales, because sales is more science, right? Number of reps into $1 million quota and all. It feels like it's easy, I'll hire reps and business will happen, but that's actually not the case, right? In fact, you should be overflowing with pipeline before you invest in sales. Otherwise, you'll just have a sales team sitting idle, twiddling their thumbs, not making quota, and you'll be sort of burning through a lot of capital.
Yeah.
No, absolutely agree with you. On the conceptual level, it remains the same, right? The brand and recognition is required to begin with to create pipeline. And unless you have a pipeline, the sales reps are just sitting on the desk and not doing anything, right? So it doesn't help long term.
Shifting gears, how easy was fundraising in your journey? How easy or how difficult, and any advice for founders?
I mean, there are
companies that raise on promise, there are companies that raise on performance. And you all have always been the latter. So tell me how.
I think when you were mentioning about the plan, I wanted to kind of share that one, and I'll let Nara add on that. Like, so I think what worked for us has been that, I mean, we always gave plans with a bit more, okay, can we achieve that plan with a reason, with like reasonable kind of like, I would say, probability and confidence. Yeah. And with a bit more bottoms up view. It's easier to say that, okay, as a SaaS company, you need to go like 3x, T3, D2, and all of that. And people actually give plans that way. I mean, I've seen people give plans because we need to grow 3x, and we give the plan 3x.
So,
But then you are, you like PD was mentioning, the pipeline is not there. I mean, you can't just grow from pipeline X to 3X in just like one or two quarters, right? So I think we basically gave always like projected to, we always had conversations with investors even before when we are actually fundraising. That's obviously one big advice that we would give. But I think the even in the for the plan we give at that point of time, we always gave plans which where we can definitely hit. And when people see that we are hitting those plans, that gives the confidence. And then just giving a plan which you are where you are missing out significantly, right? You can just add more.
Yeah, maybe I'll finish off on the plan and go to the fundraising piece. But see, I think one thing very important which people did not don't understand is that you have to have motivation in the team built out year on year.
Hmm.
While investors will push you, you know, you have to do three years in a row at least to begin with. But and if you are not able to achieve the first year, you have lost probably, I don't know.
Like, I think there's this balance of ambition and motivation and psychological safety, right? If you push your reps too hard, you know, company is doing well, but individually not making quota.
Correct.
So
I think we ensured that obviously this is a stretch, but the stretch is not so big enough that people would not even put in effort to achieve. That is very important, right? Like if people does not put enough effort to achieve.
So you're saying that the bottoms up buy-in into that plan from the entire team and then everyone going all out to kind of hit that number.
If people stop caring about the plan, then the plan is of no use.
Yeah.
So I think
we have done. And we go into details, right? Like, you know, we go into details on how, when you say revenue goes from X to 2X, for example,
How is it going to happen? Where is it going to come from?
Yeah. Where is it going to come from?
Who's going to do how much?
Who are the people who are okay to say that, you know, their pipeline can grow? Like it could be inbound, it could be outbound, it could be, you know, something else, right? Like if outbound is working really well, probably you can say that I'll invest more into SDRs and try to make it 2X of the outbound channel. But it doesn't translate exactly like an inbound. So how do you kind of estimate what is going to happen? Right? So I think very important to have then with a bottoms-up approach into operating the plan.
And by the way, that always showed up in your MIS. Even till date, I think the Moving Age MIS is probably amongst the most detailed MISs I have seen. And by the way, it's not that today when you're at Series F or whatever it is,
the MIS has remained the same for last 7 years.
From the day I've invested, you have tracked every metric that anyone in the world in SaaS who understands the business.
And my observation is it's the only portfolio company where the MIS is so big it doesn't fit on email.
Yes. It comes as a Dropbox link. Because it's... and honestly, that's where I think the partnership between the two of you also comes in, because, you know, Nara looks at the business from a very different perspective as a pure, you know, financial lens, metrics driven. There is, you know, product Salesforce productivity, there is sort of burn ratios, there's LTV CAC, there's CAC payback,
rule
by segment, by by geography, rule of 40. Like there is not one metric which one can look at, say, hey, you know, this metric isn't part of it. Now, and the good thing is you're not doing that for us. You're actually doing that because it's helping you build this business the right way.
Yeah.
Right. And I think that to me has been one of the different things, because you're building it like the right way to build it is, listen, if I'm burning too much money or if I'm going after unprofitable customer segments, I need to know. Forget the, you know, for the sake of reporting to investors.
Correct, yes. Obviously, all this definitely helps in the fundraising. So, I mean, coming to the fundraising question, right, I think.
So we have
seen all
the brunt of it, yeah.
We have seen all cycles.
All cycles, yeah.
The toughest cycle was when you guys invested.
Yes.
Or before you guys invested.
Yeah.
2015 to 2018. 18. Like later part of 2015 to 2018.
Yeah.
No, I think obviously 2015 was a great year for
2015 was a boom year. I think 2016 was like 2022. Right?
Yes, yes.
Very similar to 2024. Engage founders who did not know how 2016 was, but yeah, but 2016-17 probably was the toughest part of VC ecosystem, right? Like where not easy to get funding from for the end companies, and the bar just kept going up, right? I think we raised our Series A when we were probably less than $500,000 ARR.
Yeah.
And you generally assume that maybe you'll be able to raise Series B when you are 2 million.
Mm-hmm.
But that bar kept increasing, and we finally did Series B when we were 3.5 in ARR. And it's not easy to, I mean, obviously, if an assumption goes wrong in what you would be able to do in terms of fundraise, then it essentially means that you have to extend your runway by 12-18 months.
Correct.
Like, which is not easy unless you plan for it.
Yeah.
And even we grew like 2.5x in the year. It's not like we...
we went from 1 to 2.5 in terms of ARR. And I think that was the toughest in terms of fundraise where we had to... And not a lot of investors understood SaaS. Very few investors said who would be willing to take that bet. Today, obviously, there are multiple SaaS companies that all of us can see, which are 50 million plus, 100 million plus probably. But back then, there was no SaaS, right? And I think the biggest question was like, does this scale to even 100 million in valuation, forget 100 million in ARR, right? So, so I think toughest phase that we have seen back then. But I think the big advice, and obviously, the good part is a lot of investors have seen us for a long time. Like as you mentioned, you guys wanted to invest in series A or C, but eventually ended up investing in B.
I think that's been the consistent story of Moingage. Every round, you'll have gotten an investor who has tracked you all in prior rounds and felt they missed out and has come in. But also, because they have seen that your say-do ratio, which is I say I will do X and I will do X.
Correct.
Or more than X, it has been consistently high.
Correct.
Right? There are very few people who will look at, say, hey, at the time of the last fundraise, he gave me this plan, but today he's 40% below that, right? Which by the way, investors track. I mean, we have every plan, every company that was submitted to us. We actually go back and check.
Yeah.
In your case, if I check at every stage, you've done what you said you would do, right? Which actually really builds trust and confidence, forget amongst customers, even amongst investors, because you're doing that.
Yeah.
I want to ask you, Nara, because again, now that you were talking about it, one thing strikes out to me as you all have never raised money at obscene valuations.
Yeah.
And you are actually one of the few guys where when you got in an offer, you yourself told me, nahi negotiate nahi karna hai, ye fair price hai, right? Even though you could have potentially pushed valuation up by, you know, 20% or whatever. And I've always really respected that about you guys, that y'all are not trying to over-optimize. You actually want to pace this out the right way. And you want everybody involved with you to make money.
Absolutely.
It's never been about, hey, let me just raise at the highest price because there's a bubble. Maybe one odd round y'all were, you know, overpriced, but every other round has been basically at a fair price.
Underpriced when compared to all the rounds happening back then. Yeah.
So I guess my question is, today, you know, sadly, even today, we see companies with 2-3 million ARR raising money at 150, 200, 300 million valuations.
Yes.
Like, when you meet some of these founders, like what's your advice to them? Like, do you worry? Do you feel like you all missed out? Do you feel like, you know, they have a harder journey because they need to really keep rising to those expectations?
I think I always keep saying this to founders when I meet them. Every dollar that you're taking, think of it as a liability, right? You will actually make money when this dollar becomes 5x, not otherwise. Unless you honestly believe that you are assuming your step plan goes right in the next 3 to 5 year journey, does this X becomes 5X, 10X?
Yeah.
Do you honestly believe that? Right? It's very, you know, easy to carry away from what's happening in the ecosystem. And there are years where, you know, the valuations are probably at 10X of revenue. There are years where it is 100X of revenue. And it keeps changing, right? The market can be cyclical and seasonal. But as a founder, you have to build this company for next generation, maybe 15, 20, 25 years, right? So it's always important for people to understand that capital is not, I would say, asset, it's a liability, right? So you are taking a dollar to prepay this dollar, multiplying multiple times, right? So I think, I've seen multiple companies where we are closely associated who raised an obscene valuation, does not have a path to do what they want to do now, without naming, right? So I've seen companies raising at 100x, 200x, unless you are able to grow into that right valuation number in today's market, which is probably, I don't know, right? You know, 12x, 15x, we can debate 10x. But unless you are able to showcase to an investor that, you know, you are paying, they're paying right today, you would not
be able to raise again.
Yeah.
So, different question, and was having this conversation with a founder in the US.
Yeah.
And I think conclusion was that the lean startup is dead. And he said, if I had to start today, I would raise as much capital as possible.
Hmm.
And at least with these AI companies, like I always say, the new like enterprise playbook is the old consumer playbook, which is take as much money as possible, drown out competition, win mindshare, market share. But aren't grow they with also negative gross margins, right? I'm sure a lot of them are negative gross margins and say, yeah, okay, business and monetization, we will look at it later. But if we win, we win.
And even many of these AI companies need to be seen in the form of consumer lens, maybe. Like, because they are very prosumerish. Like you said, not enough gross margin, not recurring revenue.
Which might be for the coding companies, but there are enterprise companies who still do the 100x ARR raise, right?
So, yeah, I think what we are seeing, like you said, is recently, especially in the last year, 6-9 months, is I think, which comes down to maybe like people are trying to invest, like, okay, I want to be the category leader in the brand, because that seems to be the two things I'm seeing which will be relevant, right? Okay, one is being the category leader in the brand, and the second part is like have a product that people are sticky. If those two are there, maybe they, what you said, I think even if they invest, probably they can make that happen. But I think that is a playbook I'm seeing some of these AI companies seem to be executing.
Guys, final question. I know we're out of time. Final question. So you're closing your next round tomorrow. You guys are, it's probably going to be the largest round for any software business in India, definitely in this year, but maybe in the last few years also. What's next for Moengage? And with AI, with multiple geographies firing, just walk me through what does the next 10 years look like? When do you guys, you know, IPO, is that on the mind even? Just maybe let's spend a few minutes there.
I think firstly, like, we already did a lot of hard work in terms of like establishing ourselves in the US and some of the European markets. But at the same time, we're still scratching the surface in terms of where we are in those markets. So I think a big part of the focus for the next, I mean, I would say like 4 or 5 years is really establish, as a hashtag or hashtag player in the category. And really work towards becoming that, establishing a leadership position in those markets, like we kind of have been able to do in the Asian markets, right? So that's one part. And what it takes is obviously not just doing well on the GTM front and driving a strong customer love, but also continuous innovation on the product and reinventing our product in the AI era. Some things that we are doing, I think I was mentioning briefly in terms of like we're investing, like this year it's been all, we have been like the hashtag priority has been investing in AI capabilities across the board of Moengage. One part we are investing is the decisioning agents capabilities, which basically enables, as we discussed, automated matching of customers to the value propositions and so on. And a lot of agents from the leveraging all the generative and reasoning AI capabilities. So see, we already have done quite a bit of that, and then we are going doubling down on that front. I think if I look at 10 years from now, I mean, one part we did not talk enough about is that we have been becoming more of a multi-product company, not just multi-geography. And a couple of our products have grown significantly well in terms of our transactional messaging category of product and app personalization and web personalization product. So they already kind of took off reasonably well. So we'll invest more and more becoming like a multi-product company. We believe we have a great seat at the table with executives at these brands. So we can add more value for our customers with more products and leveraging all the data foundations that we already have, right? So I think we believe this our time is, like you also mentioning, multi-geo, multi-product. So it's a multi-billion dollar TAM for us. So we want to kind of work towards building that multi-billion dollar company. Revenue company in our category. So that's what we are working towards. Yeah.
Awesome. Anything to add?
I think he covered it well, but on the IPO question that you had, I think we obviously will be IPO ready, and we do not have any urgency to hit the markets. Again, we believe there's a lot to be made in terms of revenue for us, and we are probably one of those unique SaaS companies where the TAM is kind of unlimited, truly infinity, if I have to correlate your episode. So, so I think we obviously will be IPO readiness side, will be ready, and will hit the markets as and when we think is the right time. All the stakeholders believe is the right time, right? So,
Awesome. I know we're out of time, so I'm going to quickly conclude. I know we can keep going on for a long time because there's so much to cover. Firstly, thank you. Thank you for the partnership. Thank you for being such fantastic partners to work with. Having now been partners for the last, 8-9 years, I can truly say it's just not the success, but even just the nature of relationship at every stage. You know, I think every investor would love to have a partner like you. So thank you so much. You guys have always made sure that every investor on your cap table sleeps well at night. You all have always done the right thing and put the company above yourselves, and also put, I guess, all your stakeholders above each individual sort of in the team. So thank you so much. Really appreciate it. And wish, I know this is just the start. There's a very, very long way for MoEngage to go. And I am very optimistic that, you know, MoEngage will be one of the most successful software businesses, not just in India, but hopefully in the world very soon. So wish you all the best for the future as well.
Thank you. Yeah. Thank
Congrats once again on the fundraise. Thank you for the partnership, and look forward to the next phase of the journey.
I think we haven't thanked enough you guys. So obviously, I think I always keep telling internally that, you know, Tarun is the best sales guy that you can find.
So for the people who don't know, like, you have a VC-generated pipeline.
For people who don't know, Nara maintains a tracker. He has a tracker for his sales team, but he also has a tracker for every investor on his cap table and who has generated how much business.
So has he given you a quota?
I have not got my quota attainment bonus.
Have you gotten a commission?
No, not yet.
He has got a different form.
I am very happy with the equity we hold.
I think thanks for being always on the top of the leaderboard when it comes to investor-generated pipeline. And there's a lot to learn from all the VCs as well when they invest into a company, how they can support and ensure that the company also succeeds with their partnership. So always thankful for being with us for the last 7 years on the cap table, and obviously many more years forward as well.
Fingers crossed. Thank you so much.
I'll just add, like, our partnership with Z47 and past in the past matrix has been, like, phenomenal for us, like, both in terms of value add for the company, and also I think we have had probably Z47 is more of the, I would say, most friendly VCs as well. Where we also spend a lot of the Diwalis and all of that.
Yeah. So he's
been sure the Diwali party goes well.
So just not, I think, great partnership from professional standpoint, but also in general.
Awesome. Great. Thank you so much, guys.
If you like this episode of Zero to Infinity, there are so many more that you must check out. If you like Indian startup content, hearing about founder journeys, or knowing more about emerging sectors that we're investing in, Zero to Infinity is the channel that you need to subscribe to.